All right, we are in 1 John chapter 3, and we were looking at this section in verses 13 through 15, and we stopped at verse 15. So what we're going to do is just kind of go back and look at a couple of things here, and then we'll just keep forging ahead. So he says in verse 13, "Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. Whoever does not love abides in death." Okay? And so we saw the connection between verses 13 through 15 and the following section. And the hook word, the link word that connects these sections together is the word brother. And so he's going to talk about loving your brother, hating your brothers. He says, in 14 and 15, there's some subtle repetition that we talked about that we just want to make note of again. He talks about the brother, death, life, love, and then he kind of reverses that. He talks about love, death, brother, and life. So those are the repeated phrases. You look for these repeated phrases in these 2-3 verse section because that will tell you what that section is about. Okay, so he's talking about brothers, he's talking about death and life, he's talking about love. So in verse 13, we talked about this last time, that Jesus does a very similar thing that John does here in 1 John 3, 13 and 14. John has just talked about love, and then he says, "Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you." And Jesus carries out this very same structure in John 15. And you'll remember there in John 15 that in verses 9 through 11, Jesus, for the second time, gives the love command. And in verse 12 and verse 13, Jesus illustrates the type of love you are to have. You're to love as Jesus loved. A quality of love. And then verse 17 of that chapter concludes that section. And then in verse 18, he says, "If the world hates you," or hated you, "know it has hated me before it has hated you." So he's talked about love this whole time, and then all of a sudden, right after he ends that section on love, Jesus tells the disciples, don't be surprised if you see some that hate you, and just know that if they hate you, they hated me before they hated you. And so now, when we come back here to 1 John 3, 13 and following, John structures his thoughts the same way Jesus does. He's been talking about love and loving your brother, and then all of a sudden, do not be surprised that the world hates you. Okay? And so, just very similar to the way Jesus went about describing love and hate. Verse 14, then, we know that we have passed out of death and into life because of what? How do we know? Yep, if we love the brothers. That's exactly right. And obviously, what's he talking about when he says that you pass from death into life? Yeah, it's talking about salvation, talking about our conversion. And so, in other words, the evidence of our conversion, passing out of death into life, is based upon our love for our brethren. And we remember, right, that when we study 1 John, we try to study it with the Gospel of John in mind. So if you look at John chapter 5, he says there in verse 24, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but what? Has passed from death to life." So Jesus talks about this conversion that's taking place from death to life. And there you know that you've passed from death to life, whether you do what? Whether you hear my words and believe in me. All right? And so there are a couple or a few different ways in which is evident whether we pass into death from death to life. It could be evident based on your love, and it could be based on the fact that you have heard Jesus and believe in Him. All right, and really, you have to merge those things together, don't you? They all go hand in hand with each other. So we have to love our brethren, love each other. We have to listen and hear God's words, and we have to believe in Him. Those are certain aspects of passing from death into life. And so we come here to verse 15, which is where we left off. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So, who do you think John has in mind here when he says they are the ones who hate? And it proves they are the evil ones. What do you think he's talking about here? Or everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. Obviously, that could be a general reference, but could he have any? Okay. So he's just talked about Cain and Abel, right? He's just taught in this previous section. We should not be like Cain, he says in verse 12, who was the evil one and murdered his brother. So he's still talking about this idea of murdering your brother, which is the idea of hate. So yeah, he's just talked about Cain and Abel. I've also asked us to consider this in terms of the Gospel of John. And so if you consider John 8 and what's going on there, and then you consider John 13 through 17 when Jesus is conversing with his disciples and he says, love each other and know the world is going to hate you, it appears that the common denominator there are unbelievers. And you'll remember that in John 8, it appears as though it was those who had in some way, shape, or form believed in Jesus, but have fallen back. If you look at the context of all that, it fits right in with what John was talking about in the gospel and who Jesus was interacting with through those chapters. With that in mind, what about some other stories in the Gospel of John that may help us understand this a little bit better? So what about John 6? Remember what happens in John 6? All right, so you have the feeding of the 5,000. All right, so many were following him, believing in him in the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus then goes on to say, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, and then what happens to those people? They're gone. They flee. What about in John 8? We talked about that passage where you had those who had believed, but not anymore. What about in John 9? The blind man that was healed, and his own parents refused to acknowledge it was Jesus who did it. Because of what? Because of fear. That's exactly right. Because of fear of what would happen to them. So, it seems to me that the most logical way to look at this is that those who hate are those who had left and walked away from the faith. Those who have been of them but are not anymore. And of course, at least for my thinking, this would be the Jewish secessionists. And it's these people who are scorning these brethren because these brethren have not left. They are sticking with Christ. They are still abiding in God and loving the brethren, so they are being persecuted for that. So what John is saying now really isn't any different from what Jesus said in the past. You really need to love each other because you're going to come under fire from people like this. And these are people who no longer believe and who are attacking you. And it's important, John says, it's important that you be a close-knit group and that you stand firm in the truth. I would imagine it would be difficult for these brethren to hear something like this, because these people were among them. They probably built relationships with these people and had friendships with these people, and now they've left. And John says, don't be shocked by it, but also don't follow them. You hold fast to Jesus. And obviously this is what's relevant for them then is still relevant for us today. It's so important that we love each other. And I will also say this, that just because these brethren love each other, what about how they are to treat the ones who have left? Well, they're still to love them, but they're to love them to the extent that it doesn't cause them to go beyond what God says to do. And that is love. It's hard love, but it's love. And so we live in a society that's hostile to what, you know, our society is hostile to the things that we believe, and the last thing we need to do is be stabbing each other in the back and mistreating each other, tearing each other down. We need to be loving our brethren, because we are really, we're comrades in battle. We talked about this on Sunday, so I'm not going to hit this too much now, but just remember that in Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gets to the heart of this matter of murdering your brother. And you'll remember Matthew 5:27, he says, you have heard it was said, don't commit adultery. And then you'll notice in verse 28, Jesus tells them how to nip it in the bud. He says, it begins in the heart. The heart is the problem. And if you back up there in Matthew 5:21, he says, you shall not murder. Okay? It's an issue of the heart, was Jesus' point. Adultery is precipitated by lust. Well, guess what murder is precipitated by? Anger and hate. And so the consequence of this is eye-opening. If you're guilty of hatred and anger towards someone, then that is really the incipient form of murder. And I think that's what John is getting at here in 1 John 3 when he's speaking of those who are murderers. It's the same concept. They hate. All right, any thoughts on that? Yeah, Jacob.
In talking about how these people would have to continue to love the people who are going out for them as false teachers, it reminds me of the passage in 1 Timothy 1, at the end of the chapter, where Paul tells Timothy to keep the faith in a good conscience, even though others have fallen away in regard to their faith. And he even names two people by name.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently he knew these people and says, they're gone.
Right.
So Paul was going through the same thing.
And very specifically says, I'm handing them over to Satan.
Right.
That's right. Yep. Good thought. Good connection. Anything else? All right, so let's look at verse 16. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. All right, so what do you think is the linking word that connects 16 through 18 with 13 through 15? It's the same as the last one we looked at. He's still talking about brethren. He's still talking about brothers. If you look at verse 15, everyone who hates his brother. Verse 16, we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. Verse 17, if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother. So he's still talking about brethren and our attitude to our brethren. And you've probably noticed that this seems to be the common word actually from the beginning here in verse 11. As he's running down through here, there's still this common theme of brothers. And so he's really emphasizing our common brotherhood and how we treat each other. So look at in verse 16 through 18. Do you see a lot of words that are repeated? As you go down through there. Some of this depends on translations, but maybe your translation. Okay, love. Yep. So he says in verse 16, by this we know love. Verse 17, how does God's love abide in him? So it was by this we know love, then how does God's love? Verse 18, little children, let us not love. Okay? So, a lot of emphasis here on love. You may see the term abiding or lay down lives is mentioned here a couple times, I think. So, yeah, that's the idea here in this section. So, as we look at verse 16, by this we know love that he laid down his life for us. So, why might John be using language like this to describe the love of God? Or Jesus. What does Jesus say about himself in John 10? In that section there on the Good Shepherd. That's exactly right. Jesus says the very same thing about himself, doesn't he? There in John 10, that when he talks about himself being the Good Shepherd, no one takes my life from me, I lay it down. He does it on his own accord. And John simply says, as Christ has done for us, so we should do for the brothers. We should lay down our lives on our own accord, as Jesus has done for us. And then notice what he does. He has gone from a very dramatic statement in verse 17 or verse 16. I'd give my life for you. I'd lay it down freely. To a very practical point in verse 17. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Okay, so a very dramatic statement about love. You lay down your life for somebody. And then he goes from that to a very practical way of loving by, if you see a brother in need, he's in need of something earthly, like money, for example, what are you going to do about it? Okay, it's a very practical way of fulfilling what God has done through Jesus for us. Now, I want to think a little bit more about verse 17 because I think there's something here that will be helpful for us. I hope it is. So he says, if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, and does what? That's right, closes his heart against him, then how does God's love abide in him? And whether he means the love we have from God or the love we have for God, it probably really doesn't matter. They end up being the same. But he goes to a very practical issue, and that is helping a brother who is in need. So does this cause you to think about anything in the Old Testament? Yes, Deuteronomy 15. All right, so I want to go over there to Deuteronomy 15. It may be that lurking in John's mind as he's writing this, that he has Deuteronomy 15 on his mind as he's teaching them this practical lesson of love. So there's something really important here that Moses talks about. So Deuteronomy 15, look at verse 4. But there will be no poor among you. So they're getting ready to enter the land. He's giving them this law and he's telling them these are some things that are going to happen for you when you enter the land, some blessings that are going to come from God. There will be no poor among you. For the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess. Now, before we go on, is verse 4 ever fulfilled in terms of the New Testament? Acts 2? Yep, Acts 2. And also, remember when they give, they're giving everything to those who are in need. And then in Acts 5, or Acts 4, verse 34, there was not a needy person among them. Okay? So, in a one sense, Jesus is the fulfillment of this. And you see it through the church at Jerusalem and how they love each other by giving to anyone who had need there. You see that ultimate fulfillment of love. And it's Jesus is what allows them to fulfill. He fulfills Deuteronomy 15 through his giving himself on the cross. And then as Christians, we fulfill that because of what Jesus has done. All right, so that's just a side note. But I want to keep going here. So Deuteronomy 15:4, the basic idea is there's not going to be a poor person among you as you enter the land, when you enter the land. Look at verse 7. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother. All right, so if one of your brothers should become poor, that may leave you scratching your head, right? Because he just said there's not going to be a poor person among you, and now he turns right back around and he says, well, if there is one that's poor, so which one is it? Okay, and what you have here is a classic. Here is the ideal. If the nation follows God's law, then God is going to bless you so plentifully that there won't be a poor person. But there's going to be a poor person among you. So God says, guess what? I know it's going to happen. You're going to sin. You're going to fail. You're going to fall short. So you have this ideal, and you have what in reality actually does happen, okay? So let's read verse 7 again, and then we'll look at verse 8. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. And now look at verse 9, and I want to read this carefully. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought, where?
In your heart.
And you say, the seventh year, the year of release, is near. And your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother. and you give him nothing, and he cried to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. All right. So I want us to think about verse 9, and I want us to think about that as we come back to 1 John. All right, he says, take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart. And what is that unworthy thought? What's the scenario that he brings up here? Every 7 years, what do? Yep, they release debts. And guess what the temptation is? There's only a couple months left before the seventh year comes and we have to release the debt, right? I have to release that debt. And if I give him money, and he's not going to have to pay me back, right? God says, don't let this kind of thought or unwholesome or unworthy thought come into your heart. Now keep that in mind, and then let's turn over back over to 1 John 3. Remember that phrase, unworthy thought in the heart. First John 3, verse 17, if you see your brother in need of the world's goods, and you do what with your heart? Close your heart against him, then how does God's love abide in him? Now look at verse 18. Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. All right? So, and we're going to come back to all this as we're looking through the rest of this section here. But now he says, don't love in word or talk, meaning don't just say it, but in what? In deed and truth. The reason we are emphasizing this point about the heart is because of the next couple of verses that we're going to see now. Look at verse 19. By this we shall know that we are the truth and reassure our heart before him. For whenever our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart, and he knows everything. So first of all, before we connect this to Deuteronomy 15, you see any linking words there in 19 and 20 to the following section, or the previous section? You look at verse 18 and 19, he's talking about truth, okay? And some of these repeated words in these two verses is heart in verse 18. Actually, heart comes up twice, verse 18 and verse 19. Okay, so there's an emphasis on the heart. And remember, that's the whole point in Deuteronomy 15. And if this is the backdrop of John's thoughts here, the point of that passage is that God is warning Israel, don't close your heart. And don't let evil thoughts into your heart to the effect that you will not help another person. And so with that in mind, when you look here at 1 John 3, 19 and 20, when he talks about assuring or reassuring the heart in verse 19, and then our heart condemning us in verse 20, but that God is greater than us, that's always been a very puzzling thought to me. I've always kind of thought that maybe he's talking about, in broad terms, our own personal assurance and salvation that we have. That God is greater. And we all have the feelings of inadequacies, right? That is true, and I think that is a biblical concept. That God is greater, and he knows our hearts. And we can have confidence. But in the context, he's been talking about not closing your heart against someone in need. Again, go back to Deuteronomy 15, specifically there God warns Israel against having an evil thought in your heart to the effect that you will not help. So think about it like this. Maybe there's another way to understand what John has in mind here when he talks about assuring our heart or reassuring our heart. The New American Standard says persuade, which is what that literally means. So when he says here in verse 20, when our heart condemns us, what situation from Deuteronomy 15 would a person's heart condemn them? That's exactly right. Your heart condemns you when you see a person in need and you turn and go the other way. But what if he sees the need and begins to turn away and he realizes who's boss? And who's boss? God is. God is greater than our heart and knows everything. So maybe a more beneficial way to understand this passage is to see that here's a man, just like in Deuteronomy 15, who doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to help, but he recognizes that God is greater. And he submits to his authority anyway. And if that is the way to understand this passage, then notice how it fits in with this next set of verses. Verse 21, beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. And whatever we ask, we receive from Him because we what? What do? We keep His commandments. Okay? And do what pleases Him. So maybe John is just saying sometimes we have this struggle to want to help somebody. I mean, we are human, right? That's the reality. Sometimes we struggle to want to help somebody who's in great need. But when that struggle comes, it's important that we recognize that God is greater than me. He knows my heart. And then you decide that these people need to, me, I need to do what the Lord says. And because what God says, specifically here, love, then they have assurance before God and they please Him. They do the right thing, even though their feelings are telling them to do something different. And I think that's John's point. There's a quote, I don't know if I have that up here. I don't have that quote up there. It says, faith means trusting in God's love and making itself available for its action, despite what we may feel. Faith cannot be based on feelings, nor should its criterion of authenticity be absent of struggle. In other words, just because you don't have some internal struggle doesn't mean you're really a great believer. Okay? You may just be so hard-hearted that there's no faith that could ever survive in there. And by shifting the base of confidence, he goes on to say, by shifting the base of confidence from human feelings and inner harmony to hard faith facts about God and behavior, the author is boycotting a common religious trend, then and now, to make inner human experience the criteria for spirituality. That's spot on. How many times have you seen people living lives in direct contradiction to the Word of God? Say, well, I'm deeply spiritual person. Because objectively, they have some feeling. But John says, here's how you can know. When you see something and you have this conflict going on in your mind, in your heart, that is wanting to pull you away from God, and then you remember who is the authority. So you know what? I'm going to do the right thing. whether I want to or not. I'm going to submit to God. That's how you can assure your heart. That's how you can persuade your heart that you are doing what the Lord says. And so, 21 through 23 links to this previous section. It's the word heart. And because we're talking about doing what God says, notice the repeated word in verse 22. And whatever we ask, we receive from Him because we keep His commandments and do what pleases Him. By the way, does that remind you of something in the Gospel of John? Verse 22. Whatever we ask, we receive from Him. Okay, that's exactly right. So he does that there, and then here in John 14, 13, he also says, whatever you ask in my name, this I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. And so John kind of reiterates the statements of Jesus. And so he says here in verse 23, and this is His commandment, that we believe in the name of His Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another just as He commanded us. Whoever keeps His commandment abides in God and God in him, and by this we know that He abides in us by the Spirit whom He has given us. All right, and so it seems to me that what he is saying, therefore, is that your confidence is rooted in your submission to doing what has been commanded from the very beginning. Doing what Jesus has wanted us to do all along. Love each other. And when you see your brother in need, you help him. Because of your submission to a great God. That takes a lot of trust in God. Because it may not always seem like that's the best way to do it in my eyes. No, God says to help. Questions, comments? Any rebuttals or any other thoughts? Yeah, Michael. Good. Yeah, that's a very good point. That's probably a good example. And we've talked about how light is. We want to walk in the light to expose us for who we really are. And the other reason that's important is because of our struggle. Our struggle to always do the right thing. It's not always easy to do the right thing. And if we're not walking in the light, the light, the path will not shine a light for us to look to God and make the right choice. And so if the struggle is real, and it will be, if we're not walking the light but walking in darkness, we're going to stumble every time. And so you're right. Our heart, walk in the light, they go hand in hand with one another. Any other? Thoughts? All right. So let's go ahead and get... we have a few minutes here, so let's go ahead and look into chapter 4. And really this whole section, I do want to look at these a couple verses at a time. No, I say that. Because one of the things that you'll notice is while each couple of verses connect together by one word, there is a sense in which chapter 4, verses 1 through 10 or through 11, really all, there's a lot, there's one word that connects through that whole section here. And it's going to be this idea of spirit. And he really starts it off at the end of chapter 3 when he says, the spirit whom he has given us. All right, so he kind of gives us a hint of what he's getting ready to talk about in chapter 4. And he's going to talk about how to test whether a spirit is from God or not. And so, if you look at verse 1 through 3, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you heard was coming and now is in the world already. Okay? So I have these sections up here, and I already answered the first question. The hook word is spirit, verse 24, and then chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. What are some repeated words that you see in this section, or some repeated phrases? Okay, yep. Yep, that comes up a few times, doesn't it? This idea of something being from God or of God. Yep, very good. Anything else? Okay, yep, confess comes up a couple times. Which is also throughout the book. He talks some about confessing, what all that entails. So spirit comes up approximately six times, or maybe a few more depending on your translation. So, yeah, spirit from God, confession. And so there's a test that John gives his readers to know whether someone is a true or false prophet. And what's the test? That's exactly right. Whether they confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. And we've talked a little bit about what that means in terms of Jesus coming in the flesh. And give that some more thought. This is one of those verses that if you have a view of Gnosticism running rampant through 1 John, then this is one of those verses that they like to talk about. So think about that, whether he's trying to refute Gnosticism or whether he's simply saying Jesus is in the flesh is really just simply that you deny Jesus as the Christ or the Messiah, which is what the Jews did. So a couple ways to look at that. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. The test is there, and it's all a matter of whether you confess Jesus as Lord. And so you get to the same point or conclusion either way you look at it. But think about that and go ahead and study verses 1 through 10 for Sunday. All right, thank you.